Hello, listeners of the Accents podcast on WUKY. This episode has been brought to you by Accents Publishing, an independent press for brilliant voices. I am the host, Katerina Stoikova, and my guest today is brilliant poet and friend, Rebecca Gale Howell. Hi, Rebecca. Welcome to Accents.
Hi, Katya. It's so good to see you again.
As soon as I heard that you have a new book coming, I knew I wanted to read it and talk about it on this podcast. This is not only a brilliant book, but also a very unique one. Please tell our listeners how Erase Genesis came about.
Well, first of all, thank you so much for wanting to be with it and for those kind words. It's a little bit of a surprising story, I suppose, and you're one of the people I know I can trust to understand what I mean when I say I don't fully understand how it came to be. I can tell you the circumstances that surrounded it. I had a commission on my desk to write a poem for my friend Marcus Wicker, who was leaving his long tenure as the poetry editor of Southern Indiana Review. And Marcus and I are poetry family from the Fine Arts Work Center in Provincetown. And so I was thinking about our friendship and that winter that we shared there in 2010, 2011. I was writing Render and reading a lot about climate change and understanding it really in a concrete way for the first time in my life. And I was walking around Provincetown, which is a very rare landscape, very extreme and beautiful, and realizing that because of sea level, I was walking around a place that probably wouldn't exist once sea levels rose. So, you know, these are the kinds of thoughts that started to rush back as I meditated on my friendship with Marcus. And where we met and what formed our friendship. He's also a contemplative Christian, as am I. And I struggle to say that phrase because the word Christian has come to mean so many things that I disagree with, but I'm trying to teach myself to honor what that word means to me. And he and I share that private sense of the sacred and that background. And so all of this sort of came together in my heart. And I thought, well, what would happen if I started engaging the creation myth directly and held this in my heart as I worked? And the poems just started talking. The book is built, as you know, because you've read it, the book is built through simultaneous erasures of the same first three chapters of the book of Genesis. By that I mean, I'm going to the same source chapters repeatedly and finding new poems every time I go to the same source text. And what I found as I worked is that the poems were not only distinct from each other, but we're compiling into a new story, a new creation myth, or what I've come to understand as a recreation myth for climate change. So the book surprised me as much as anyone. And that has everything to do with how I approach poetry. I am interested in coming to poetry as a way to to find out what I don't yet know, to seek new understanding of what confounds me, to be in the presence of mystery, to be surprised.
What I always say is, how do I know if the sentences in my head is poetry or just another thought? It surprises me. That means it comes from someplace else. Whatever that means, even if it means from a part of me that I don't have access to. Would you read the last section of the postscript?
Here I have practiced a poetry of silence that writes not against, but alongside a text I have loved my whole life. I have come to these first three chapters of the book of Genesis, repeatedly asking them to teach me that we can still be made in the likeness of God, that we can still learn how to be quiet, how to be with. In this edition, the erasure is done by water and paint, by hand, because I wanted to become a physical part of the story that was making me, because I wanted the physical world to remake me through story. By redacting the same three chapters in different ways, I approached this book as a kind of literary translation. When I am translating, I come again and again to the source text. I come to participate in its creation. And in so doing, I am created. I am changed. I do not come to the text to assault it or upstage it. I come to know it. And in knowing it, I become a part of what really does want to be fruitful and multiply. The human imagination for connection. The book of Genesis can never be erased.
A complex text has many threads going through it. And it seems to me, I read this book as there is this thread brought to the foreground, there is that thread brought to the foreground, and the order that they are presented one after another matters much in the way that if you are weaving a cloth, putting the different colors one after another matters to the final product or to the experience of the reader in this case. Did you really draw by hand with watercolor?
So every page in the book is its own painting. So they're not done digitally, they're all done by hand. And as I said in the postscript, and as I just read, I did that for a few reasons. I wanted something that these poems taught me, reminded me, is that our physical experience in this world is what in fact ties us to the silence that I know to be divine. That it's not a conceptual process, it's not a artificial process, it's not a digital process. In fact, the more we draw into our opportunity to be physically present with the natural world, the more I draw into that opportunity, the quieter I get because I just want to listen and be a part of it and not upstage it, not dominate it, just be my tiny small part. And so the paintings were a contemplative practice for me of that, right? How can writing these poems, how can writing this book, making this book become a meditative practice that's physical? I also wanted a natural element to be the agent of erasure. And I tried a few different options, and water allowed for the paints are watercolor, and water allowed for softness that I wanted to offer the reader and the text.
I imagined myself doing something like that, and I imagined my heart beating fast and being afraid that I'll mess it up and probably messing it up. And that being, I mean, it has an opportunity, it has a potential to be a stressful experience and a restorative experience. Knowing myself, I would have had difficult time making it restorative experience. What was it like for you?
Sure. I'm really glad that you brought this up. I don't remember if you meditate, you can tell me or not, but I've had a long meditation practice since my 20s. I sat Zen for a couple of decades, and these days I sit transcendental meditation. I bother to say that because what you just described is the experience of meditation, right? Like whatever you bring to the meditation is the meditation. And there's a part of the practice that is learning how to accept that. That there's no such thing as a perfect sitting. It's just the isness of it, you know, the moment of it. And so I know that fear of messing up and that frustration and that voice in me that can be very self-critical and who at her core is very afraid of failing other people, poetry. And I wouldn't say that she's gone away. She's very much there. I've just learned over the years how to recognize her and speak compassion to her. So, yes, of course, while I was making the paintings, I had moments of real frustration and that voice in me rearing up and getting mad at myself because I was messing it up, air quotes. But then it's just part of that larger practice in my life of learning how to be.
Please read us from the book.
So the way the book is organized, as you noticed, is a collection of poems that are made from chapter one, then a collection of poems that are made from chapter two, a collection of poems that are made from chapter three, and then the book circles back. Then a few more poems from chapter two, and a final set from chapter one. And so the book is organized in a kind of a circular sense of time and opening to hope. So I'll read to you the first few poems from chapter one and maybe one or two from chapter two. In the beginning, divide. Divide waters from waters, firmament and firmament under the heavens there for years. The lesser light to rule his kind, dominion over all and upon man in his own image, in the image of he, him said, have dominion. To you it shall be meet. Or the earth, the sea, the air over you. And the earth said, one place, the dry land. And it was so dry. And Earth said, bring forth the fruit tree whose seed is in itself, the evening and the morning, the day. Firmament and firmament, two great lights made to give the evening and the morning, the day. The earth, the earth. The earth said, behold, I have given you the earth. So Thus all the day made work blessed and sanctified because it made generations create the day. Every plant, every herb grew, the water, the ground, the man breathed, and there the ground knowledge went out and became the first gold. But the knowledge is not the man. Out of the ground formed every call and name and shame. Thus the generations of the field compasseth the whole man, saying, evil alone will cause a deep sleep to fall. Thus the heavens and the earth, the earth and the earth breathed into his nostrils a garden. And the same man commanded, man should be alone. And he slept.
The whole time I read this book, which actually could be read very quickly on the first read, and then it could take you a long time to read it every subsequent time, I had the distinct feeling that this has been handled in a holy manner with reverence. I felt that because I regularly got goosebumps while reading and making the leaps that you made through the erasures. So that brings me to my next question, which is talk about the editing process. That must have been different from other projects.
Oh, that's interesting. It's interesting because, as I said in the postscript, I think of this as a kind of literary translation. And I wonder, as a translator yourself, if this is true of your practice. When I translate, when I learned to translate, I learned how to translate in a particular way, which is to say, from the same, I translate poetry from the same source poem. I will create several simultaneous versions of that source poem. So normally, writers are taught to draft first, second, final. So they're taught to draft hierarchically. This version is better than this version, right? But as a translator, I draft laterally. Everything is equally valuable. And once I have the versions in front of me, I can step back and kind of learn from them, right? Because here I foregrounded this technique, here I foregrounded this one. What is my, when I come to these versions as a reader, what is my experience? And what happens when I combine this technique with this technique, right? So, in other words, I learned to learn from the versions themselves about the opportunities ahead. And as a source writing poet, as a poet who writes poems that emerge from the ineffable within me, I've developed a practice of doing that as a poet as well. And so when I was writing American Purgatory, it was absolutely true. I would do, five, six, seven versions of the same poem, and I would hang them up and live around those versions and develop a physical relationship, an intuitive relationship with what my experience was of those versions, trying to learn from them about, again, what's the opportunity here. So it's a way of editing that is generative and centered in a receptivity and a trust that the work knows more than I do. And so that's been my approach with this book as well. Of course, this book is built to show everybody the different versions, right? And to kind of pull back the curtain on that practice. And while I was working, while I was making the paintings, and while I was listening for the poems really early on, it's kind of difficult because doing it with the Rice Genesis, everything started to hologram. So I would be looking for listening for the language that might want to be in this particular poem, and then another poem would start. I would start to hear it, right? And I would know that it wanted to live as well, but it needed to be a separate utterance than this one. And so there was a lot of trying to keep up with the book.
So they appeared in parallel almost.
Yeah. It is my deep hope that this book can create opportunity for other people to practice this. This is what happened when I came to the text. I'd be very interested to know what happens when you come to the text with paint and receptivity, and what is the sacred that finds you there on your terms, right?
I guess it would depend on the relationship one has with the text.
Yeah, and with oneself. Yeah, and I would argue with the natural world.
Well, I think that a topic will surface naturally, and it may or may not be the natural world. What do you think? Like if somebody else takes the text and creates erasures, maybe it would be a different story entirely.
Oh, sure. Yeah. I just meant that I've come to a place where I don't see a division between the vast intelligence that is what we call the natural world and poetry.
And how do you know when an erasure poem is finished?
How do you know when your own poem is finished when you're working?
One, I like it. Two, I know that I cannot do any better even if I try. Those two are enough already. And also, there is an element of time. A friend of mine said once that time is the best editor. So if I look at something today, I might consider it finished, and 3 years later, I might tinker with the ending.
Yeah, I don't know how to put into words the feeling I have when I feel like, okay, this is the version that wants to be with readers. It feels in my mind and heart and body like in the same way it feels when you're unlocking a door and you've got the you land the key into the lock's configuration just exactly right, and it turns and you can feel everything turning right. It feels like that to me.
The book is gorgeous. Tell us about the book design. Describe it to our listeners.
I'm really thankful to the press's designer, Alicia Beebe, who was willing and open-hearted to collaborate with me for months. I wanted it to feel like a book of hours in the hand. And by that, I mean, much like what I was saying regarding the paintings, that I wanted to be a part of a physical process because that engages my animal intelligence. That's what connects me. That's my most honest bond with the natural world, is my body. And so for me, that was a really vital part of this work's remaking of me. And I wanted to create an object that invited readers into a quiet, contemplative relationship with their own body. And so I wanted the book to be a subtle but sensory experience, something that was quiet, but textured and intimate. So we designed it to be a smaller trim size so that it would fit in the hand in a particular way. And I wanted it to be a linen covered hardback so that the natural fabric the cloth would create a sense of softness and tenderness for the reader from the beginning. The book's cover does not have the book's title on it, and it does not have my name on it. It has a Zen circle that I painted. My name and the book's title is only on the spine. On the back cover, there are no blurbs. It's the closing Zen circle that I painted. So one opens, one closes. And I wanted to do that because I wanted the reader's experience to be silent at the very beginning. I think a lot of what this work is pursuing is understanding quiet as a shelter. So that's the front cover. And then the end papers of the book are a woodcut by the Kentucky artist Harlan Hubbard, who lived with his wife Anna, subsistence off the Ohio River. And I love his work, and so I'm really thankful to the estate for allowing me to welcome this woodcut into the end papers of the book, and to have him present with this book is really meaningful to me. He was a part of an artist collective that is at the center of this book for me in Kentucky. Yeah, so the book, the pages are deckled, so it creates a texture at the edge of the page. The paper is Italian paper. There's a hand-sewn ribbon bookmark. I wanted to create an object that would invite the reader into their own sacred quiet on their own terms, in a moment of spiritual solitude.
Tell us about the publisher.
Bridwell Press is the press out of Southern Methodist University's library. And Southern Methodist University's English department also has a poetry initiative called Project Poetica. And they were launching a poetry imprint and solicited a manuscript for me to help found the imprint. And honestly, I still kind of can't believe that they wanted to publish this book, but they did. I'm really thankful they have believed in it absolutely every step of the way, without hesitation, with full heart and full collaboration. They've been just a dream team. So the imprint is Project Poetica, Bridwell Press, and I just could not have asked for better partners in this process.
I'm sure they're proud of this book. Are you proud of this book?
I'm happy that this book is in the world, and I'm happy it wanted to be sung. I mean, much like I think poetry is just another bird singing, it's a part of the natural world, not separate from it. I do think of poems as songs, and I'm grateful to this book for wanting to be sung and wanting to sing on its own terms. Because of the way I work, which is listening, not thinking about, but listening for, it always feels a little disassociative to me to have my name on a thing, right? Like I kind of don't think it's mine, It's mine to be the right steward of and to take good care of, but it's something that happened to me, that moved through me. It's not something I feel like I did. If that makes any sense.
But it did come through you. You were the one with brush in your hand. You were the one who made decisions which were to be brought forward and which to stay in the background. Do you consider this book continuation or a turning point in your work? And also walk us through the titles of all your published books.
Oh, sure. My books of source poetry or original poetry are Render and Apocalypse and American Purgatory. and now Erase Genesis. Another interviewer was asking me about the title of Erase Genesis and how I came about it, and I said, and it suddenly made sense to her that I just tend to title books what they are. Right. So Render is an apocalypse myth, and I'm happy to talk about what I mean by that. I don't mean the end of the world. And American Purgatory is a purgatory myth. So naming the genre that those books are. An Erase Genesis is an erasure of Genesis. So I tend to think in kind of pedestrian ways about how to title a book, for better or for worse. I do think this is a continuation of my work. I think I have been without realizing it, and now I realize it, that what I've been doing is writing new myths for climate change. And this is obviously a part of that chase. And, for me, if I understand anything about what I know to call divine, its name is the natural world. And so, working within the spiritual imagination has always also been a part of my body of work.
Do you think the earth would be fine without us?
I do.
We're
I
making a
think,
mess, aren't we?
yeah, we're making a mess. I think one thing that writing Erase Genesis taught me, in the King James Version, the translation reads, I think, errantly, that man is endowed with the right of a dominion to dominate the earth. And that's a mistranslation of the source. And what a consequential mistranslation. Because as soon as we, I don't know if other animals have the capacity for imagination, but I do know that we have it, and that our engagement with our imagination defines our engagement with our actions. That what we imagine is how we act. And once we imagine that we have been endowed with dominion, we are imagining that we are separate.
But it's about mastery, right?
Yeah, so far as I understand it, the closer English would be mastery, which is to say to know. And the King James reads dominion over. Over is wrong too, an incorrect translation. It means more like to be with, or to know among, which is completely different than dominion. And if we had held that translation as sacred instead, what else might we have enacted?
We'll never know. Which brings me to, we must let go of what we want to know to find what we need to know. Say more, please.
So that's something from the postscript in the book. So I'm a professor of poetry and translation, and I'm working with apprenticing writers all the time. I find myself saying constantly now, what happens when you don't come with an agenda? What happens when you don't dominate the poem that's trying to sing to you? What happens when you listen to it instead? And that's my practice with poetry, but it's increasingly my practice with my whole life, that listening is, I find it an infinitely trustworthy practice.
Oh, there it is, dominion versus mastery.
Learning. Yeah. Yeah.
I loved the fact that the explanation of the work was in the postscript. I loved that the book led with the source and ended with the explanation. Was that decision that came early or late for you?
I would say it was a part of making the object of the book as a part of the work of the art. When we were designing the book, I don't remember what caused us to do it, but I just really wanted the source to be without redaction at the front, so that readers had it available. Again, I just want the reader to have their own experience and to value that. And I knew at some point that the ideas that grounded the book would need to be available, but they didn't need to be the priority. And so I was glad to move them to the back, you know.
You mentioned your students, and I have a question that I ask all my guests who teach creative writing. I've asked it to you before over the years. What is the most important thing you teach your students? If there is one thing you want them to remember from your class or workshop, what is it?
Let go of control. Trust the poem to be larger than you. Find out how it surprises you. I don't, as you said so eloquently at the start of this conversation, I don't understand neurologically how it happens. You know, it's some part of me, or it's the vibration of the universe, or a dream that I had the night before that I've forgotten. It doesn't matter to me. I just know that it will sing for itself if I let it. And every time I've gotten out of the way and listened, it has not only transformed itself, it's transformed me. And I'm deeply grateful for that practice.
Brilliant. Thank you. Are you translating anyone currently?
I'm not, no. The plan is that this is the first book in a trilogy, and I'm working on the next book now. And so in that sense, I'm translating, because I do think of this practice as a translation. But that's sort of where my mind is right now.
That's so exciting. There will be more.
If they want to sing, there will be. Yeah, so far so good.
Well, I wish you with all my heart in not too distant future for Rebecca Gayle Howell to visit again the Accents podcast on WKY with another brilliant, exciting, and immersive title.
Well, thank you so much. I'm privileged to be in your company anytime.
Thank you, Rebecca. All the best.
Thank you.